The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Krotowski. On the show this week, it's a gaming clash of the titans as the Xbox One takes on the PlayStation 4, and caught in the middle is the Guardian's games editor, Keith Stewart. I'll be asking Keith to wield the sword of Damocles and guide those wishing to make that big Christmas gaming purchase. Also, I'll be joined by the Guardian's tech team to look at this week's tech stories. The UK loses its digital champion as Baroness Martha Lane Fox stands down after just over 3 years in the role. The government's Crime and Security Minister, James Brokenshire, announces imminent measures for censoring extremist content. And Amazon announces a plan to use drone technology to deliver its packages. Another vote for the mundane future. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Last week, Crime and Security Minister James Brokenshire announced government plans to, quote, block extremist and terrorist websites, unquote, from the UK digital space. Charles, is this even possible?
Well, the way it's already the case that some websites are blocked from inside the UK, BT uses a system called CleanFeed, which a lot of the other ISPs, almost all of the large ISPs and many of the smaller ones subscribe to, which blocks a lot of known child pornography sites. The idea is that I think something very similar would be used here, that a number of websites would be added to a list which would then in effect be unavailable from inside the UK. Quite how effective that would be is a completely different question, because when you have things like, you know, when you can use VPNs, virtual private networks, you can effectively tunnel out and be accessing the internet from a different country, which means that you're no longer bound by what CleanFeed prevents you seeing.
Do you imagine that kind of thing is going to be on the rise? I mean, most people know VPNs. In fact, they probably don't even think that they're called VPNs if they think that they're VPNs, but they think about going into their work server if they're working from home. Do you think more and more people will start to use VPNs to do things that they, you know, that are, say, geolocation cached?
I don't think it's going to become a common pursuit. I don't think that the average man or woman in the street is going to say, yeah, my VPN provider is so-and-so. But I think that as we see more and more websites become SSL, using secure sockets, as the sort of general concern over privacy and security ratchets up, I think that you might see more people using VPNs. But I think that in the case of a lot of these extremist websites, what they're talking about here, that people who are determined to access them are probably going to find a way to do it anyway.
I slightly wonder that the sort of mission creep we've already seen with systems like CleanFeed, it's damaging its own aims. CleanFeed began as a list of child pornography websites. But then last year, the Pirate Bay was added to it, the largest BitTorrent search engine. And, you know, once you start adding things like that to these systems, then more and more people are given motivation to try and find their way around it. Geolocating is a good example. You know, most people who use VPNs now will use it to watch the Daily Show clips on the American website rather than the Channel 4 website. You can get browser plugins that do this.
I was in Argentina and watched the opening of the Paralympics.
Exactly.
Which was Channel 4 only.
Mm. I mean, these, they're not...
Arrestado.
Hey, it's an available technology that's easy to download. I didn't even have to pay for it. I just switched it on.
Exactly. And they're not marketed as... get around the nasty government links. They're marketed as get around these commercial systems which are in place, but they're all fundamentally the same sort of system, and they can all be bypassed in the same way. So the more you get low-level things using it, blocking it for commercial imperatives or blocking things like the Pirate Bay rather than child pornography, the more you end up popularizing the tools that actually mean that things we might all sit down and agree that actually maybe this would be best being hard to access can be accessed easily.
So here's a question, taking a step back there, Alex. You mentioned that things like CleanSweep were initially adding child pornography sites, and then they started adding others like the Pirate Bay. I'm curious about the they. Who is the they in this situation? And actually, Charles, you please pipe in as well. You know, who would decide what is an extremist and a terrorist website according to the government?
Well,
We have the Internet Watch Foundation. Nobody knows anything about it. It's slightly shadowy, you know. So who is it that would be doing this?
Well, it would be the High Court would probably hand down a judgment which would come from the government, which would have, in one way or another, declared that it thought that this fell under a particular remit and therefore it should be blocked. That was the case with Pirate Bay. That came through a High Court judgment, and with other providers of content which have been blocked in the same way. It either comes out of the Home Office or else it comes out of court judgments. So the question of can you challenge it becomes an interesting one, because... what's the mechanism? It's not clear what the mechanism is actually for challenging this at all.
I can also imagine that's quite a slow process.
Could well be.
And
yes.
By the time something is handed down, the bad guys have gone somewhere else.
It might be, although if it's done in secret, then the only way that people would know would be when they will get the website. But of course, that they'd have ways, I'm sure, of communicating the fact they couldn't get the website back. And I think it's been the case in the past that where the intelligence services want to monitor an individual or monitor people who they think might be bad actors, in the worst sense, then actually they say, yeah, we'd like to see who's looking at this website. And if that website ceases to be available through those sorts of feed, then it becomes more difficult for them to monitor these people.
Fundamentally, they don't want to drive people onto things like Tor, onto the darknet, because you can monitor extremist websites that use the normal functionality of the internet. It's a lot harder to do if people are actually using Tor.
I just have an image in my head now of Howard the Duck sitting in a kind of basement typing, the dark web into Google or something. I'm sorry, when you said bad actors, Charles, it just stuck me there. Alex, how are the ISPs responding to this? Do you know what the response is? Because this came down from on high. What are they saying?
Yeah, I mean, some of the ISPs are outspoken against this sort of thing. So I think TalkTalk have been pretty firmly against doing anything they don't have to. But at the same time, once they have to, none of them are outspoken to the extent that they'll shut down their business rather than comply with this sort of filter. And then the other problem is that CleanFeed is fundamentally a voluntary system. It has its roots in an agreement by all of the ISPs that if they were given a list of sites of child abuse images, they would happily block them. And then once they had a list of sites that were blocked, it was quite easy to jury-rig that into something that was a list of all sites that were blocked. So you end up with this list that's got two purposes. It's half voluntary sites that they all agree have to be blocked, and then other half sites that they have been told to block that they're just using the system that's been built up. So it's very hard to split those two things into, we'll block half the sites on the clean. So you end up having to build your own list of sites, and then it's on your head if you miss... So in the end, it's just a lot easier to go along with what everyone else is doing.
It would be interesting to have somebody, say, from BBFC come in and sort of talk about the evolution of how they've decided what works or what doesn't work. How things that should be banned or should be blocked has evolved culturally as well over time. Charles, when you're looking at this kind of top-down suggestion from the government, what do you think that it represents in terms of how the government understands how the internet and the web works? Is it a logical step, or are they grappling?
There are two ways of looking at it. The general way that one would look at it is that for most people, it would be effective, because they wouldn't actually be able to work out how to do it. For a smaller core of people who are determined, who might understand more about encryption, about SSL, about VPN, about Tor, about darknets, about SSH tunneling, all that sort of stuff, for them it's going to make no difference at all. And the question that we don't really know the answer to is how many of the people who actually are the ones we should worry about are aware of how to get around these sorts of blocks, and how many aren't aware. And possibly the government knows the difference here, and possibly the security services know the difference here, and I really hope they do, because if James Brokenshire here is actually just making a lot of sound and fury, and they sort of add a few websites to this and say, look, we did this, and actually they're able to monitor the people who they want to by keeping the particular websites that they know people are using in view, and easily in view, then that's actually quite an effective sort of agenda, because they please the Daily Mail, but equally they're able to keep tabs on the people that don't. If they go overboard and just do all sorts of things in a stupid, unthinking way, then actually they create more problems than they solve.
Keep an eye on this at theguardian.com/technology. When the UK government announced they were looking for a digital champion in 2010, they found a perfect match in Baroness Martha Lane Fox, a shrewd businesswoman, strategist, and of course, she has her digital chops. She was the darling of the first dot-com boom as one half of travel broker lastminute.com. But this week, after 3.5 years promoting the digital agenda inside Whitehall and beyond, she announced that she is stepping down from the post, effective immediately. Charles, let's go back, mists of time. What was the goal of the role? Can you remember when this first came out? What did you first know about this role?
So actually, Martha Lane Fox was doing a role rather similar to this back in June 2009, when she was working on, again, sort of digital inclusion of getting people online. And that was under Gordon Brown's government. And a big role was to sort of talk up the benefits of being online, that you could get cheaper power, cheaper power tariffs and stuff like that. Although at the time when I spoke to her in June 2009, I thought that she wasn't very well briefed. She hadn't really sort of worked through the numbers, and that when you talked about getting sort of millions of children online, that they could earn billions of pounds more in their lives, it actually worked out to about £100 each per year. Which wasn't really very much, and that didn't seem like you're really selling the benefits of it. So in that sense, I thought that, you know, the aim is a good one. You know, I think getting people online is a good aim, but that's not quite how you sell the benefits. Then in 2010, you had the change of government, the coalition took over, and they advertised for a digital champion, which would be someone who would talk about the digital agenda inside government, as well as trying to get more people online. So they'd do a dual role, which is to talk about the benefits of getting online and also push central and local government to get people online as well. Martha Lane Fox was appointed to that job in June 2010, and at that time, about 10 million adults in the UK were not online. Now we come 3 and a bit years down the line, and the number who are not online, according to the ONS's latest data from August, is about 7 million. The question is, has she been successful? And this is an interesting question, because if you look at mortality data, about 500,000 people die every year. Most of those are old. And in the case of people who are not online, you probably figure that most of them are old. If you assume that all the people who've died were people who are not online, that's about 1.5 million. So you've had a move from 10 million people who are offline to 7 million who are offline. That's about 3 million. So if you assume 1.5 million and just people who grew older, they came online because effectively you started counting them when they reached 16, then about 1.5 million people have been brought online by all these efforts. Is that success? I don't know.
Well, actually, I want to take a step back even further. And what do you think that the government's interests, either administration's interests, was in having a digital champion? Because bearing in mind, 2009 was around the same time as we started to see, you know, in the US, there had been a huge excitement over, you know, what the technology could do for politics. Mm-hmm. And we started to see, you know, CTOs of the White House and of the US government. To what degree was the UK government trying to explore that same phenomenon or jump on the...
Yeah, there was a lot of excitement about it, and Francis Moore of the Cabinet Office still has responsibility for trying to get the government to be digital first, and Martha Lane Fox was given the task of trying to basically go around stirring up excitement about doing this, and seems to have been effective about that. She got a lot of plaudits from people inside the GovUK team who seemed to say that, you know, she was effective in getting things done there. So, one can't argue with that. If they say that she did the job effectively, then, you know, clearly she did. The wider question of governments and digital, that's interesting. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of excitement about that. One feels that a bit like with the green stuff, that David Cameron is maybe sort of just not so interested as he was. I noticed, for example, the Conservative Party used to publish a spreadsheet of all their, certainly cabinet members and senior MPs' expenses. They used to publish that online. Stop doing that.
Yeah,
now.
Well, they also used to publish other speeches online.
Yeah, that went, and then it came back. It was a mistake. you just made a mistake.
All the way down to the Internet Archive was a mistake.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But, what can you say? I feel that, she probably did more effective stuff inside than we saw outside, but maybe the job of digital champion is one it's one of those sort of burrowing away, doing things in meetings, getting task lists actually ticked off, and it's not the sort of thing where you're appearing in, hello, or I'm a celebrity, get me out of here all the time, and, sometimes that's actually the better thing to do.
Quite. And Alex, thinking about what's been happening within government over the last few years, perhaps we should be fair on Martha and the idea that, she's been burrowing her way through Whitehall, knocking on doors and bringing up a digital agenda internally, because it certainly seems that the government has embraced and is starting to make leaps forward. Perhaps we should not look necessarily at the figures that Charles is looking at in the immediate, this is what's happened over the last 3 years, and maybe project something long term. What do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the big thing, of course, is that if we're looking for someone who's fantastic at going around and knocking on the right doors, then Martha Lane Fox, for all that she might have done it well, was, it was pretty much luck that she was quite good at that. If you want someone who is a fantastic internal actor, you probably want to hire a relatively dull civil servant who knows the right doors to knock on and who has 40 years institutional experience of going around knocking on doors and banging ministerial heads together. Martha Lane Fox, a fantastic businesswoman and someone who knows the internet, if she was good at the banging heads together part, that was by the by and frankly incidental to the reason why she was hired. I think if we're looking at the really long term, then the interesting question becomes what similar things to getting the country online is there for the next generation of digital ambassadors? And the digital switchover is something that I've been thinking about since, it's basically over now. We've done it. We did it quite slowly, but we have largely turned off the analog signals. But that's not the only time this is going to happen. Periodically, we have to retire old radio spectrums and move them on. The reason why most of us don't have 4G now is because the digital switchover was quite slow. And that's something that is worth sitting down and going, okay, you know what? Once people are online, we can't just leave them on the old methods that we got them online. There's something like 20 million people in America who still use AOL's dial-up service. I'm sure because
it's a big country.
But also because you're on dial-up, you're ticked. You've got the box ticked that says you're online. You don't need any more institutional help with your digital setup, and you're left. And eventually, one day in America, they're going to have to move people off dial-up when they perhaps just end landline service at the home. It'll be tens of years' time, but those are still problems, and you need to start thinking about them clearly, even more in advance than we thought about the analog TV switch off. It will be interesting to see how the government tackle that, how they go around telling people on non-3G mobiles that we're going to be switching this off now.
It's difficult, though, because there's so much within the government walls that involves, seeing numbers rising. And some of these things are, some of the real issues that we're now seeing now when it comes to digital are actually things that are a lot more difficult to tick off. Things like literacy. How do you identify if somebody is digitally literate in all of the capacity that means? And also what you're talking about as well, Alex, is how do you make sure, without just simply looking at numbers, yes or no, that we are starting to tackle some of the real issues that are involved in technology as part of our lives, not just something that's, that we use as a tool. Mm-hmm. So anyway, more on this, of course, Kelsapriese, it's what I do all the time, at theguardian.com/technology. On Cyber Monday, the future became a little bit more boring. Amazon, the online retail giant, released a video of it. It was an amazing video. It was a video to the internet, to the web, that announced from 2015 they were going to implement an army of drones. An army of drones.
Army of drones.
But not to take over the world.
For a heavy metal band, don't you think? Army of drones. This is our new single.
Army of drones, Amazon. One click. I can imagine next year's 2014 New Year's resolution for the podcast is going to be a rock and roll band. Anyway, their army of drones was not to take over the world.
Christmas
number one.
I can see it. Or to perform creative backflips in sequence, but to deliver your stuff. And to be fair, the footage does look very cool. You get this spider-like robot picking up your thing in a secure orange box, and it takes off from its chute and it flies through the air. It lands carefully, gently in the back garden of a well-to-do suburban family home. But is this the new reality? Charles, before we even get into the nitty-gritty, I live in a flat in an urban sprawl, right? I'm like, I'm not suburban. I don't have like a lovely, glass door that I can just open and my drone will be there with my orange box, which I'm annoyed by the orange box because what are you going to do with an orange box? It's just going to fill up landfills. Anyway, Charles, what do I do? What do I do? I want my drone.
Well, I'm sure they'll come equipped with glass cutters, won't they? It's got to... Thank you.
Deliver it late at night when you're not even aware it's there.
There was a really,
intimidating at all.
There was a really great a photograph of somebody who mocked up a
Quantum Pirates. Yes, yeah. Quantum Pirates one, which is fantastic. Yeah.
It was wonderful. It said, what's going to stop people from shooting these things out of the air? But honestly, what is this initiative, Charles? What do we know?
This initiative is about. Okay, you want my opinion? Please. My opinion is this initiative is about Amazon knowing that there are going to be lots of stories right ahead of Christmas of people saying, here's my experience working as a wage slave in the Amazon warehouse, which indeed The Guardian did have a fantastic piece by Carol Cadwalader about her life in the Amazon warehouse for a week working as a picker, which is not great. And also there's going to be articles about Amazon, how little tax does Amazon pay? Oh my God. And also there are going to be people thinking about Cyber Monday, which is going to mean they're going to think, I wonder where I should buy my online stuff from on Monday. And fantastically, amazingly, coincidentally, on the Sunday night before the Monday morning when everyone's going to be heading to their browsers, Amazon has this piece of footage about a totally impractical thing. If you think, how many deliveries does Amazon actually make? Okay, you've got these gigantic warehouses with all these people toiling hours on end, delivering all these things and packing all these goods and sort of putting boxes into crates and stuff and packing it with paper. Okay, and then you're going to get drones to deliver it? Seriously? No, you're not.
In individual orange plastic non-recyclable boxes.
What it is, we're in a really interesting situation, an interesting period for technology where the cool-looking physical stuff is actually quite easy these days. Quadcopters or octcopters or all of these various types of helicopter-based drones are literally children's toys. I mean, the Parrot AR drone is an expensive kid's toy, but it is sold as a toy. It is a quadcopter that you can't really carry anything with, but you can film from high up and you can fly it with an iPad, and it's great fun. But it's a toy. There's nothing particularly impressive in Amazon using this. The really difficult stuff, which would be amazing if they got sorted out, is all of the boring things like logistics, like actually having a 3D map of a major metropolitan area, which includes things like wires and pylons and trees.
Oh, yes.
Amazon doesn't have that, and Amazon's not going to have weather. That by 2015.
Wires, yeah. Power wires, power. Telephone wires.
There's
all
no,
those sorts of utility
there
wires.
Is not
those
a map.
Horrendous.
There is not a map of that.
And
which
there
is,
never could be, because it keeps on changing as much as anything.
So
trees, which are seasonal.
and grow and get bigger
and get
over
bigger,
time.
Get smaller and, buildings which appear.
But these are all
sounds
really
like a,
boring
a
things.
Virtual world that people are building here.
Like, there's nothing whizzy about showing off your new technology for accurately mapping whether or not that's a telephone wire in front of you or a bird that's going to be away. You can't do a lovely 90-second promotional video of that. Mm. So no one asks Amazon to include it in its promotional video. All you get is the stuff which we already have as a children's toy, which is someone flying an octocopter with a remote control. Yes.
And an orange box.
And an orange box.
I'm so annoyed by those orange boxes.
And can I also remind you, from March 2012, the Pirate Bay said, we've had this great idea. We're going to put our servers on drones. And I said, no, you're not. And has the Pirate Bay put its servers on drones? Could I just ask?
Well, Amazon can learn something from the Pirate Bay.
Well, indeed, but I mean, this is the classic thing. As Alex said, it's about logistics is so key, and there will be people at Amazon who work the most amazing magic, really, with logistics about where should we go, where should we take it, how do we deliver, what's the best path, all that sort of the classic traveling salesman thing. And that wouldn't look so good on a computer screen. It wouldn't look so good on a TV screen of having the guys hunched over going, if we minimax this one, then we can actually save about 15 pence on the fuel bill.
The most obvious reason why it's a PR stunt is that if they have the really boring logistical backend that would let them actually do this, then they would be able to do that with self-driving cars as well, which wouldn't require having something that has a battery life of 30 minutes and can only carry one package, you know.
In an orange box.
If you can do the boring logistical function of getting a self-propelling vehicle from A to B, put it on wheels, don't waste all that energy carrying up into the sky and then back down on the ground, and you can carry 500 boxes in the same vehicle.
Extraordinary. you can go to theguardian.com/technology and probably map when self-driving cars stopped being the future. Like right there, we exactly. have evidence. Now we've moved into drones. Anyway, you can go
Volvo,
there.
Could I just say, Volvo Please. Is going to be doing a test with self-driving cars next year in Göteborg, in Sweden. Maybe we should go.
I think we should go. Let's put a bid in. And if you would like to support our Kickstarter, no, I'm just joking. Anyway, you can go to you can go to theguardian.com/technology and keep your eyes and ears there. The consumer season has begun in earnest, and this year the big prize little Jimmy and Jane want under their Christmas tree, or I suppose it's not Hanukkah bush because we've already had Hanukkah, is an all-new, incredibly powerful gaming machine. Microsoft and Sony are vying for the top spot with their Xbox One and PlayStation 4 already in the shops. And we are joined by The Guardian's games editor, Keith Stewart, to fill us in on the latest battle of the consoles. And Keith, when I say the latest battle of the consoles, we've kind of been here before. What's the feeling, the general feeling about this battle of the consoles?
Well, I think it's interesting because for the last 2 years, analysts have kind of been telling us that the console, the sort of traditional games console, is pretty much coming to an end. People have been prophesizing the death of the console for a while. And I think the fact that that hasn't happened, not only has it not happened, but sales figures recently have shown that the very opposite is happening, has surprised some people. But the Xbox One and the PS4, they've had very, very long marketing campaigns. And there's been a lot of built-up demand because it's really been sort of 7 or 8 years since the last generation of machines first arrived. So I just think there's a lot of people who have been introduced to games over the last few years through other platforms like iPhones and tablets who have now got kind of games in their mind, who have become kind of excited by this build-up, and as a result, the machines have done really, really well.
That's actually a really important point, I think, because I recall the cycle was a heck of a lot shorter before, and so it was almost as if you got your machine and then you were already saving up for the next one, for the next iteration, for the next version, the even more extreme one. But you're right, it's been a long time since we've had a new console. So tell me a little bit about these machines. Let's start with the first one to market, the Xbox One. What can gamers expect from that if they haven't already plugged it in?
Well, I think really with both consoles, what we've all found about them is that they're very similar technically. They resemble very stable, reasonably powerful PCs. They both have very similar graphics cards. They both have very similar 8-core CPUs. The big difference with the Xbox One is that Microsoft have geared it very much towards being a sort of all-in-one set-top box. So they want this thing to control everything in your living room, from your games, obviously, to your TV. You can slip an HDMI cable from your TV input set-top box to your Xbox One, and then you can use it to sort of control that. It can control your audio system because Kinect is an IR blaster, which means it sort of almost operates like a remote control. And they've really thought about Xbox One as I guess kind of like a living room entertainment brain, and Kinect is a very important part of that. The Kinect device, which is a motion controller, which was kind of controversial and not that great on Xbox 360, is now much, much better. It's very precise, it's very high resolution in its scanning of your room. You don't have to live essentially in a tennis court for it to work anymore. You can get much closer to the thing, and you can use voice control with Kinect as well, and with your headpiece, so you can talk to Xbox, you can talk to your telly, you can talk to it to turn your volume up and turn it down, if that's the kind of thing that kind of excites you. It doesn't me, because I'm too embarrassed to do it, because my walls are too thin. But I guess the whole idea with it is this thing is the master of your entertainment experience. That's what Microsoft wants.
I love the idea that you know, some people fell in love with Siri, the voice-activated search facility on the iPhone system, on the iOS system. And now people might fall in love with their Xbox in the same kind of way.
Yeah.
Or their television. Please.
Exactly. And the Kinect is actually really, really good. And once you input your physical features, the Kinect camera can actually... can recognize you when you come into the room. So, and it comes up with a little script message saying, "Hello, Keith." And
that's
then it brings,
actually slightly creepy, Keith.
I know. It is.
You're
like,
stop talking to me, television.
Yeah.
Nah, don't tell me to not eat the bacon for breakfast.
I know. I suspect, I mean, there's obviously, there is actually an Xbox Fitness, there's an Xbox Fitness app, which is a fitness game, but because the Kinect camera is so high fidelity, it can actually pick up changes in your skin color and uses them to sort of triangulate your heart rate and your pulse rate. So it knows if you're out of breath, if you're exerted. So, I mean, I think we're probably reaching a point where it will probably look, if you sit there with a TV dinner in front of you, it will probably say, well, you're not playing a game until you get rid of all those cards off that plate.
Hot on the Xbox One's tails was the PS4. Tell me about that machine.
Well, PS4 has been really interesting, because I think at a very early stage in its development, Sony brought on a guy called Mark Cerny, who's actually a games developer, and he became the system architect. And Mark Cerny's worked on some amazing games. He worked on the earliest Sonic, well, the Sonic games from Sonic the Hedgehog 2. He worked on games like Jak and Daxter, really great pivotal arcade adventure games. But he's also a great technical brain as well. And they brought him on board because they wanted developers to love working on this machine. Developers hated working on PS3. It was a very, very complicated system. It had a cell processor. It had eight synergistic processing units, which were really difficult to write for. PlayStation 4 is all about making the hardware, the brains and the guts of the machine, accessible and adaptable for developers. So developers really like using PS4. And at the same time, they've really marketed it as a games machine. They've said, although we will do stuff like video on demand and music on demand and things like that, this is a games machine. We love games. We want you to appreciate games on this machine. They've also gone out of their way to court the indie games community as well. So there's lots of really interesting small-scale or smaller-scale productions on PS4. They've caught onto this idea that lots of the interesting, innovative ideas are coming out of the indie gaming sector. So when they first showed off PS4, they had Jonathan Blow, who made the beautiful Xbox 360 platformer game Braid. They had him on and made his new game, The Witness, an exclusive. And this was a really big deal, because this is a one-man development studio being used by a major global corporation to show off their new piece of hardware. So Sony is about indie gaming, and it's about gaming in general, but with this sort of a side portion of video and music on demand.
Okay, so let's say there's a fallen gamer, right? Let's call me a fallen gamer. I haven't picked up a game for a while.
Right.
And in fact, I can't remember the last time I owned a console, which I know it's terrible, isn't it? It actually is terrible. which of these, if they fell underneath my Christmas tree, which of these should I open first? What will bring me back into the fold?
As I have played SingStar with you very late into the night.
I think there's video of that, Keith.
I'd maybe push you towards PlayStation 4, because I think not only is that have they got that great understanding of wider scale gaming, SingStar was a great proposition. They have that understanding of bringing more people into games, and how games can be cultural as well as just things that teenagers will play in their bedrooms. But also PlayStation 4, as I said, has all those interesting indie games. And I think if you're a lapsed gamer, or if you're someone who doesn't usually play games, or maybe only plays games on iOS, I think some of the stuff that PlayStation 4 has got coming up, like there's a great game called Octodad, which is this weird physics adventure, which is absolutely hilarious. I think it's niche games like this are going to interest people who aren't that into great big guns and exploding aliens and that sort of thing.
That's also good.
Yeah, it's fun, but it's good to be able to do both. And I think Xbox One, apart from its lifestyle, all of its lifestyle pretensions seem to be on the entertainment side, the video side, the television side. And its games lineup, its launch games weren't that great, and what's coming down the line for Xbox One is stuff like, you know, Halo, more Halo, and maybe more Gears of War and some Fable. So it's very much in that traditional demographic.
Now, there were hiccups in the launch of at least the Microsoft console. Have they sorted everything out? What were they? It was something to do with the frames per second and some other things that were a bit wonky?
Yeah, well, they've both had a few slight issues, but it seems to be quite contained. And these are two companies that have managed to manufacture and ship, over a million consoles each. And within that, there's always going to be, you know, with any consumer electronics rollout, there's always going to be a percentage of failed machines. And I think both of them have had that, but I think it has been contained.
Okay, so we've heard about, you know, what a fallen gamer or a lapsed gamer like myself, which of the consoles I should be looking for. But let's say I'm a hardcore gamer. What major exclusives are coming up in the next year that will sort of drive me to buy one of the other machine or rip open the packaging on one or the other machine under the Christmas tree?
In terms of the launch exclusives, it's tilted slightly, I would say, towards Xbox One, because I think Forza Motorsport 5 is a really, really beautiful looking racing game. But it also has this really interesting idea called Drivatars, which is an AI representation of your driving behavior, which you can put out online and allow your friends to play against. So I really love this idea of avatars coming to represent us online, even though it is slightly creepy. But it's also got Rise, Son of Rome, which is a really gory hack and slash game with lovely visuals set in the Roman era. Those are really two quite strong titles. Whereas PlayStation 1, it's big titles. PlayStation 4. This is all becoming very confusing. PlayStation 4 has Killzone, which is a pretty traditional, gritty sci-fi shooter, and Knack, which is this third-person action-adventure game, which isn't that great. So actually, Xbox One at the moment has better games, and it has some good exclusives coming up. If you're into Halo, there'll be a new Halo game, and also Titanfall, which is the new game from Respawn Entertainment, that was set up by the creators of Call of Duty. That looks lovely as well. That looks amazing. But with PS4, they've got some amazing. Sony has some amazing studios within its stable. So we're going to see a new Uncharted title, and that will look beautiful. Drive Club, which is this interesting persistent world driving game by the UK development studio Evolution, also looks really, really good. And we'll get stuff, brilliant stuff from Media Molecule, who made the Little Big Planet series.
That's fantastic.
So I think it's kind of like down to taste. I think your taste.
My personal taste. Well, my personal taste would be to create a driving sim that has an avatar of what I actually drive like. That would be quite bizarre. Instead of just what I drive like in the game. Fabulous. Anyway, thank you very much, Keith Stewart, our games correspondent, games editor, all of that wonderful stuff. You can read more about the latest battle for the living room at theguardian.com/games. That's it for this week. Thanks to our team here in London, Alex Hearn, Charles Arthur, Keith Stewart, and producer Jason Fitz. I'm Alex Kratowski. Thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.